Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. This is Larry Warren along with Doug Wells, the usual duo here to talk about all things to do with money, how to use it and invest it and all of that. And we have a fun show today, Doug, because we're going to be talking mostly about, well, exclusively about innovation, about getting things done in creative ways. We have three guests today who all are involved in entrepreneurship, innovation, cell phone apps, all the rest. And first, we're going to talk with Dan Ward. And Dan is a 20-year Air Force veteran and engineer. He's been involved in all manner of military technology, and has written the book FIRE, F-I-R-E, with a period after each letter, Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained, and Elegant Methods That Create and Ignite Innovation. So we'll be talking with Dan in just a moment.
Yeah, no, it's a very different world today than it was 20 years ago. Did you ever think we'd have somebody in from the government, from the Air Force, talking to us about innovation?
No,
But Dan's got some great advice. It's going to be a good conversation.
Yeah, it's the same bureaucracy that produced $800 hammers, but has also produced just incredible technology.
And we're going to hear that story, and then we're going to stick with our entrepreneurship innovation theme. Our second guest is going to be Lindsay Mangoni. She is the executive director for the Center of Entrepreneurship. And they are doing a one-week program where students will learn about innovation and how to do design. Many of our audience may have heard of Stanford's Design School. It's called D-School. Harvard has an iLab, and the Center for Entrepreneurship is kind of borrowing the best of from those schools and running a program. We'll hear more about that. And then our final guest is going to be Wills Mahoney, the co-founder of Plows and Mows. And they have an app where if you want somebody to come mow your lawn or come wintertime, come plow your driveway, you can do that right with your iPhone app.
There's an app for that.
Now there is an app to mow your lawn. How about that? So it'll be a great conversation. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Gary Cole with Cole Sport, longtime supporter of KPCW. We hosted the first Back Alley Bash over 2 decades ago. It's still going strong, and we invite you to join us. Our annual community appreciation party will be held on Friday, June 27th at the Townlift Plaza on Main Street. Join old friends for live music, food and beverage, and family fun. Proceeds to benefit KPCW. Beach attire requested.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. Welcome back to Mountain Money. Dan Ward is on the line with us, and Dan, Doug and I both have really been looking forward to talking to you about fast, inexpensive, restrained, and elegant methods that ignite innovation. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, thanks so much, gentlemen. It's great to be here.
Well, we're pleased to have you, and I guess to get started, let's talk a little bit about your career. You've spent something like 2 decades in the U.S. Air Force helping to design, I suppose, things large and small.
That's right. That's right. About 20 years on active duty, doing a wide range of things, everything from laser research to satellite projects to IT infrastructure and things like that.
And the argument you make in the book is that to innovate, you don't need tons of money and a huge research team, that sometimes you can get it done faster and better with far less resources than I suppose most people would think you need to throw at a big project.
Absolutely. And in fact, my research and my experience both indicate that we get our best results when we have a skeleton crew, a cannonball schedule, and a shoestring budget. So the fundamental message in my book is that innovation doesn't have to cost so much, take so long, and be so complicated. We genuinely get our best results when we take a more restrained approach and use short schedules, tight budgets, and small teams.
You know, lately there's been a lot of news related to not really the Air Force, but really aviation and space with Elon Musk, space with his SpaceX program. And what kind of things is Elon and his team doing that allows him to send payloads up to the space station for what I heard was 1/10, 1/20th the cost of what it would cost NASA?
Sure, that's a great question, and I don't have a lot of firsthand experience with that specific program, but I can tell you that in a wide range of similar programs, we really do see on the order of about 1/10 of the cost, getting us not only comparable capabilities but better capabilities. So, for example, NASA in the 1990s had their faster, better, cheaper missions, and they did about 15 missions for the total cost of what NASA spent on the Cassini mission to Saturn. So it was about on the order of 1/15 the cost of previous attempts. So, for example, the Pathfinder mission to Mars was literally 1/15 the cost of the Viking mission to Mars from the 1970s. Pathfinder was the first time we put a rover on another planet. The Viking had just been landers versus rovers.
And what was the change in thinking that allowed that project to be 1/15 of the previous project?
Sure. Yeah. So the change in thinking, I think you put your hit the nail on the head there. The change in thinking is what drove the change in behavior. And the change in thinking said, look, it is good and important to have a short schedule. It is good and important to keep our costs constrained. So that led to things like 3-minute meetings. There was a project that intercepted an asteroid that they managed the whole thing with a 12-line schedule. It was a deep commitment to simplicity, to restraint, to not trying to solve our problems by adding time and money to the project, by trying to live within our means.
And why is that the result? You know, the conventional wisdom would be to get something done, you throw a lot of money at it and a lot of brain power at it.
Right. Well, when we try to solve our problems by adding time and money to the project, what that generally does is it ends up extending the schedule, extending the budget, and then that leads to a mismatch between the need we're trying to satisfy and the technology that we're trying to build. We just tend to get off course. But when we have a short-term delivery date, you're much more tightly aligned with the need you're trying to satisfy or the problem you're trying to solve.
And, in fact, you argue the counter that more investments of time and money reduces innovation.
Absolutely, reduces effectiveness and innovation. So the opening story in my book is this thing called the Condor Cluster, which was developed by the Air Force Research Lab. And when they cut the ribbon, it was the fastest supercomputer in the whole Department of Defense. They built it for 1/10 the cost of a comparable supercomputer, but they built it out of 1,760 PlayStation 3s. So they basically cobbled together a bunch of gaming systems and made literally the fastest supercomputer in the whole department. You would never take that approach if you have a lot of time and money. You only take that approach when time and money are tight.
Well, let's talk about another project. And I want to preface this by saying, you know, like the mission to Mars, I think one of the openings there was, it is okay to fail, right? You're going to try new things. It may not work that are going to reduce costs. And there were no human lives at stake. It was money. It was time. It was a way. It was an opportunity that folks weren't able to achieve if it had not succeeded. But let's talk about there's a 2.5-kilometer bridge in the south of France where they took a very innovative approach. And I would argue there failure is not an option. How do you do this innovation where, you know, if you're wrong, the consequences are high?
That's a really important point. I mean, failure is always an option regardless of whatever methodology we take, whether we're going to be the fast and expensive route or the slow, complicated, and expensive route. Either approach can fail. Now, you're right, with NASA's faster, better, cheaper missions, it was all unmanned missions. But their success rate was remarkably high. Now, for that bridge, you know, certainly when you're building a bridge, you need to make sure that bridge doesn't fall down. And we've been building bridges for thousands of years, and even today, bridges still do fall down. So, you know, bridges aren't going to be perfect. But that particular bridge in the south of France was one of those huge mega projects, big civil engineering projects, spent a lot of time and money on it in an absolute sense, but it delivered ahead of schedule and under budget because they made some very smart process decisions about, you know, sort of constraining the complexity of how they do things. Also smart design and engineering decisions, the way they set up the architecture. Initially, they had thought, hey, we have to do this big, expensive, complex thing but they didn't settle for that first assessment. They said, what if we simplified it? What if we streamlined it? What if we reduced our schedule and our budget? What impact would that have? And they end up with something that ended up that actually was better than their initial idea.
You know, Dan, we have a minute to talk about one story since you've talked about the NASA faster, better, cheaper missions. I saw one of those fail with my own eyes in the West Desert of Utah. NASA was bringing back the Genesis experiment, which orbited the sun and collected the solar wind, which would be particles from the beginning of time. And it was so fragile the way the particles were collected that they had to have the thing come back all the way from the sun, parachutes deploy, and then helicopters had to snatch the parachute in the air to gently lower it to the earth. And I watched as the parachute did not deploy, and it came crashing in at terminal velocity. And when they did the post-mortem, they found out that they had the switch to activate the parachute was wired backwards. So faster, I guess, maybe sometimes, can lead to disasters.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at all 16 missions that NASA launched under their Faster, Better, Cheaper initiative, only 10 of them succeeded. So we could say, 10 out of 16, that's not a very high percentage of success. Or we can say that's 10 successes for the price of one, compared to the Cassini mission to Saturn, which is the sort of the comparable benchmark. So we got 10 successes for the price of one for the same amount of money. Some of those were failures. And when you did a failure analysis at those, how did those missions why did those missions not succeed? It was generally communication problems, management issues, and sort of engineering mistakes. And those three types of those categories of problems, categories of failures, are not unique to the faster, better, cheaper method, and they're certainly not ubiquitous across that method. You know, any approach can have communication problems. Any approach can, you wire something backwards. The nice thing is when you wire a faster, better, cheaper mission backwards, you've minimized your exposure to loss. You've constrained the pain of losing that particular mission because it wasn't decades and billions. It was smaller quantities of time and money that you've invested.
And I think that's what most people are striving for, right? To put in the amount of time that's needed to do the job well, but no more than that. And you've got
as much as necessary and as little as possible.
Exactly. And you've got some nice tips in your book that I want you to share with our audience. And I want to start with, if you would, what you call reductive thinking.
Right. Yeah. So reductive thinking is an approach to doing problem solving that's a little different than what we typically do. When we think about creation and invention, we typically think about it as an additive approach. We create something by adding to our design. Reductive thinking is more about creation by subtraction. And that may sound like a counterintuitive approach or an oxymoron, but it's what a sculptor does. You take a large block of material and you chip away until you have only the essential elements, the essential components of that sculpture, that statue, whatever it is you're making, carving, sculpting, whatever. So the idea of applying that mentality, that approach to reduce as a way to improve.
So, you were in a position of authority. You were relatively later in your career with the Air Force when you started studying this and implementing it. So you had a position of power. What about for folks that are part of an organization, they're just drowning in useless meetings, useless email, there's a better way to do it, but they're not the boss yet. They're not at that stage in their career. What's some advice you would give for folks to sell this up the organization?
Absolutely. And I really began doing this kind of thing as a relatively junior officer. And so the idea is for the decisions that the individual gets to make, for the problems that they get to solve, we can always make decisions and solve problems in the direction of speed, thrift, and simplicity. So we maybe can't fix everything. We can't apply this across the board unilaterally. But for the area of our own influence, we can apply these principles, these practices, these tools and techniques in our own realm and then let it sort of prove itself and expand itself out from there.
And you can give your boss a copy of Dan Ward's book, Fire.
That would be great.
I'll put in the plug since you didn't grab it.
Thanks.
Talk about some other principles of the book. You have one called storm draining, which sounds like a lot of information dropping into a little funnel.
Yes, yes. So storm draining is a sort of a group activity that I came up with as a follow-on activity to brainstorming. Everybody's heard of brainstorming where you get a group of people together and we come up with a whole bunch of ideas. So after you have a brainstorm, the next step is to do a storm draining activity where we sift through those ideas. Again, this is one of those reductive thinking techniques, reductive thinking approaches, where we really analyze and say, okay, let's get rid of that one, that one, that one. Oh, here's the one we want to keep. And it's a way to sort of filter down to get to the core, the most valuable concepts and ideas on the table.
Another thing that's fun about your book is how you weave pop culture into what could be a technocratic kind of book and isn't at all highly readable. So explain why Superman beats the Death Star in a fight every time.
You know, I had so much fun writing this book and like you said, weaving in all these pop culture references, a lot of science fiction, a lot of superheroes, a lot of movies and things like that. And one of the questions that I address in the book is who would win in a fight between the Death Star and Superman? And that was actually inspired from an online conversation that I saw several years back. And of course, the answer is Superman would beat the Death Star in a fight every time, not because he's so strong, but because he's so agile, because he's small and able to move a lot quicker and respond to a changing threat environment in a way that a big, expensive, slow-moving entity like a Death Star simply can't.
So, but the Death Star is as big as a planet.
Right.
And so that's its problem.
It's a moon-sized battle station, and that is its number one problem. When you have something that's so big and expensive and so complicated, it's almost inevitable that there will be some thermal exhaust duct that got overlooked, and somebody's going to throw a missile down that thermal exhaust duct.
Some switch that got wired backwards.
Some switch that got wired backwards, that's absolutely. So one of the ways we mitigate those problems are by simplifying, again, our processes, our designs, and our organizations.
Do you think we're designed as humans to default towards complex, as opposed to simple, elegant, quick, and fast?
Oftentimes, yes. I think engineers in particular, and I have three engineering degrees myself, so certainly guilty in this area. But the typical engineering response to a problem is to add something. Again, the inverse of that reductive thinking approach. Complexity looks like work. When I make something more complicated, it looks like I've improved it. I've certainly changed it. So what we really need is a more thoughtful, a more mature look at what really constitutes an improvement. And in fact, we find that simplifications, making the design more elegant, more streamlined, that's the really powerful contribution. But yes, complexity looks like work. Complexity looks like we've earned our paycheck. And if we're not careful, if we just have a superficial analysis of that, we can overvalue complexity. And that's the source of a lot of design problems and engineering problems.
You know, the reason I ask the question is, you know, you see these profiles of companies in the Bay Area, which are typically shown as examples of innovation. And you look at that and you say, wow, that's the type of company I think we all want to work at, right? There's energy there. Folks are doing what it takes to get the projects done. It's fun. It's a big market. And then you look at big Fortune 500 firms, and they're very different. Although some of those startups are now Fortune 500 firms in the Bay Area themselves now. But I just find myself wondering, why is the default towards that kind of hierarchical system that's slow and cumbersome versus the startup atmosphere way of thinking of things that's exciting and looks fun?
Sure. And I think when a startup is first getting on the ground, they want to succeed. And when they look around and say, what does success look like? And they see these big Fortune 500 companies, and they begin to adopt some of the, or shoot for some of the superficial attributes of these big companies, like their complexity, like their formality. Companies like Apple, of course, are pretty good at insisting on maintaining that dedication to simplicity. And in fact, there's a company called 37 Signals that does some great software projects, and they just changed their name from 37 Signals to Basecamp, named themselves after their number one project, and said, look, you know, we used to have five or six different products. We are going to only focus on one product now. It's just going to be about Basecamp because they really wanted to maintain their success, focus on what they're really good at, and emphasize both to themselves and to the world that deep commitment to simplicity. And it's been a tremendously successful strategy for them.
Yeah, and I think Apple's a good example too, right? Like you said, NASA's Better, Faster, Cheaper project. Not all the projects worked. I'm a huge Apple fan.
Sure.
But, you know, 2 years after they kicked Google Maps off of the default position on the iPhone, Apple's Map app still is plagued with problems, which is just bizarre to me that you have one of the best technology companies in the world and they can't figure out this map application.
Right. It is unusual. It is difficult to explain. But I think that part of the explanation is that no company is perfect, no team of engineers is perfect, and you know, failures will happen no matter what your approach, no matter what your strategy. The thing is with this FIRE approach that I write about in my book is that when we fail better. These failures cost us less and teach us more.
Hey, Dan, you served in Afghanistan for a while. I believe you got a Bronze Star over there. You were in Kabul at the International Security Assistance Force. Did you find in helping be an engineer behind the scenes in what's a pretty difficult combat situation when you're essentially dealing with a guerrilla war, that there was much in the way of technology that helped in that battle? And did you design things that got implemented?
So my role over in Kabul wasn't strictly a technology role, but one observation I did make while I was over there is that war is austere. I sort of knew that before I went over, but when I got over there, I really hammered that lesson home, and that is that, you know, for engineers, whether we're military engineers or otherwise, we tend to like to make sort of shiny objects and over-engineered solutions, unfortunately, sometimes. And when you actually get over there, you find out that what works best tends to be the simple, low-cost, inexpensive designs and systems. Those tend to be the ones that can hold up to the rigors of an austere location.
Hold up to the rigors, and I would think also get used by the soldiers on the ground. When somebody's shooting at you, you know, you need to be able to grab it and have it work intuitively, and it can't have a lot of buttons and a lot of gizmos.
Absolutely, and after Operation Iraqi Freedom happened, the Army wrote a great report called the OIF report, and they said complexity reduces systems to irrelevance. So the more complex your system is, the harder it is for somebody to learn how to use it, the harder it is to maintain, the more likely that system is to just be deemed entirely irrelevant and left behind.
So let's talk about when the FIRE system may not work, or examples of where folks, on the surface at least, seem to do everything right, but the project didn't succeed. You have an example of a low-cost fighter jet called the F-20 Tiger Shark. What happened there?
Sure, yeah, the F-20 Tiger Shark is a fascinating story, kind of a tragic story in a way. It was developed by Northrop in the late 1970s to be a low-cost fighter, about one-fifth the cost of the next level fighter up, which would be the F-16. By all accounts, it performed really well. It passed its tests and was really hitting all its marks. But long story short, Northrop didn't sell a single one of these F-20s. What happened was, under the Carter administration, the F-20 was approved for sale to foreign militaries. The F-16 was not. When President Reagan was elected, the policy changed, and all of a sudden the F-16 was available to be sold to our allies. And never mind that the F-20 was probably a better fit for those allies' needs in terms of easier to maintain, more affordable, easier to train. You could get a pilot trained up on how to fly one of these on the order of 2 or 3 days. Took a lot longer to train somebody to fly and maintain an F-16. But the foreign militaries much preferred to fly the same aircraft that the U.S. pilots flew. And so once the F-16 was an option, that's what they went for. So the F-20 was very fast and expensive, very restrained, very elegant. And that is exactly why they failed to sell any of it, because it was almost too simple to be credible. It wasn't as prestigious as the F-16. But most analysts kind of look back and agree that a lot of these companies or countries would have been better off buying and flying those F-20s instead of the F-16s.
Our guest this morning is Dan Ward. He is the author of FIRE, How Fast, Inexpensive, Restrained, and Elegant Methods Ignite Innovation. Dan, thank you for joining us this morning, and more importantly, thank you for your service to the country.
Hey, thanks so much. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Great conversation. Thanks a lot. Dan Ward, you can find him at thedanward.com. And the book is published by HarperCollins, just out and selling well. So
all right.
That's all great. Thanks very much, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
And our weather today looks terrific. Perfect Park City day. A high of 76 and nothing but sunshine.
Unless you're trying to get your lawn to green up. I won't mind a little bit of rain in the next. Have we got any rain at all in the forecast, Larry?
Yes, but it's always a slight chance, a 20% chance, which is like saying, don't blame us if it rains, but don't expect it to. So, slight chance of thunderstorms Tuesday night and Thursday night. So,
all right, and stay tuned with us. Up next is Lindsay Mangoni, the executive director for the Center of Entrepreneurship, and we're going to continue talking about entrepreneurial ventures. You're listening to Mountain Money on KPCW. Please stay tuned.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
Hi, this is Bob Dillon, a lawyer in the Park City office of Jones Waldo with 38 years of legal experience in complex real estate transactions. Proud supporters of KPCW, Jones Waldo provides local businesses with legal services in areas ranging from real estate to employment law. Our website is joneswaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. You know, I love talking about entrepreneurship. Larry, you know, some of these startups here are really exciting.
Indeed.
And we're going to stay with that theme. In studio with us now is Lindsay Mangoni, Executive Director of the Center for Entrepreneurship. And they have a one-week program that they're going to be launching here pretty soon. Lindsay, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So why don't we start with what the one-week program is, the folks that the program's targeting, and what folks can hope to get out of the program.
Absolutely. So our first one-week program is called Innovation in Action, and we have both a junior institute and a senior institute. The junior institute is for kids aged 11 through 13, and seniors are 14 through 17, and the focus is to teach kids how to think and act like entrepreneurs. So what we're doing is a series of creativity exercises, design thinking activities, and a lot of self-reflection and helping kids kind of pursue their passions and their purpose so that they can pursue more meaningful careers in their future lives.
I think it's great that you're starting with kids at that age, just getting them aware of what the other alternatives are out there.
Absolutely. Yep. We think that there's tremendous advantage in exposing kids to new ideas and new ways of thinking. We just finished a four-week program in Atlanta at a high school there, and we allowed kids to meet millions of different, well, I shouldn't say millions, a few different entrepreneurs in the area and go on field trips and really explore what's out there. So getting kids in touch with those types of people and asking questions.
This program is going to be in Park City?
This program is in Park City, yes.
Okay, and will part of the lineup include entrepreneurs coming to visit and telling their story to the kids?
We will do that on Friday, yes. Okay. So we will have student presentations and we'll welcome people from the community to come
now,
in and talk.
Yeah, now this is quite an age range in terms of sophistication of kids between an 11-year-old and a 17-year-old.
It is, yes.
So how do you start with an 11-year-old and get them thinking in entrepreneurial terms?
Well, the first activity that we did actually this morning when we started our first camp was to have kids come up with how many different ways they can use a paperclip. So starting small and thinking creatively with lots of new activities that really challenge them to associate different things and to observe what's going on and question. And through a series of different exercises and techniques, we get them to kind of open up their minds and think differently. And one thing that we really stress in our camps is failure is good. Failure is a way to learn. And for 21st century jobs, you're going to have to fail to innovate. So we try to create that safe environment for the youngsters to really expand and think differently and realize it's okay to be silly and creative and fun.
And that's exactly what Dan Ward was saying as our first guest, is failure is not failure.
You know, you think about it, though, Larry, we kind of inadvertently teach our kids that failure is a bad thing.
Yes.
Right? And then they become fearful of it, and they don't take opportunities that they're likely to succeed but may fail, because they're so worried about the potential of failing.
Absolutely. We really have a lot to do to help even high school kids realize that you have to try. You have to be willing to fail. So that's something that we stress day one of the camps, and we focus on the mindset. You may be familiar with Carol Dweck, a psychologist and professor at Stanford, who has done a lot of research on the growth and the fixed mindset and found that the growth mindset instills a lot of positivity in kids and expands their ability to, you know, through effort, evolve and become more creative, more intelligent with time and practice. And that's something that we try to emphasize day one with kids is you really can become more creative. You can become more innovative, and you just have to have that mindset.
You know, I heard something where, like, if an art teacher goes into a kindergarten class and asks kids, how many of you consider yourself to be artists? Like 9 out of 10 hands go up.
Right.
But when you go to junior high or high school and ask the kids, how many of you considered yourself to be artists, only 1 or 2 hands go up. And it's different, but it's related to the creativity. And I think things we can do to spark that with our kids. And, you know, one of the things I do, through my company, invest in small companies, talk to the entrepreneurs, and also try to teach my 11 and 14-year-old daughters this. If you frame it as, here's an interesting question that's worthy to explore and try to find the answer to. Sometimes you find the answer when you raise X dollars, and sometimes you don't. Or you find that the answer to the question is, no, we shouldn't put any more money into it.
Yep.
But just framing it differently. It's not, we're going to conquer this space, but here's an interesting space. I've got a couple questions that I think would be interesting to explore. I think people are much more likely to try and to step out and potentially put themselves in a place where they don't build the next Google.
Right. We've noticed that schools today are starting to, and have been for a while actually, teaching kids that there's only one right answer. So they test, in numerous ways to get kids to think, you know, how to solve that one answer. And one thing we're trying to do with our camps is realize that there are a lot of open questions that don't have just one answer. There are many different ways to approach a problem. And one of our influences is Sir Ken Robinson, who had a wonderful TED Talk on how schools kill creativity. So we think that really having these open-ended questions and stressing problem solving and creative thinking is a great way to really stretch kids' creative abilities and help them realize their numerous possibilities, numerous alternatives.
So I'd suggest to anybody interested in the camp for themselves or for their kids, you can go on Google. And we mentioned earlier there's a company in the Bay Area called IDEO.
Yes.
It's IDEO. You can YouTube that, or Stanford's D School. I think it's Michael Arrington is the head professor there.
Yep.
Wonderful lectures there in 20 minutes. It's not a typical lecture, Larry, where somebody's up there pontificating, but it's more of a kind of a thought and just it's really inspiring. It's kind of like a TED Talk. It's really not a lecture. So do that. And then let's wrap up with the kids. The kids here have a busy summer. So what is the week that you guys are offering this here in Park City? And is there still room for enrollment?
Well, our enrollment is actually full at the moment, but the week is looking pretty exciting. So day one, we start with defining what it means to be an entrepreneur. And we take the kids through a design thinking exercise to get them to understand what the process is to approach open-ended questions. And then we wrap up with a series of self-reflection activities to really get the kids to debrief on what they learned and think about how they can challenge themselves this week. What do they really want to get out of the program? And the rest of the week is set up fairly similarly. We start with creativity exercises in the early parts of the session, and then we move on to mindset and what it means to be an entrepreneur and an innovator, and take them through other design thinking activities. And in fact, we have a capstone project that we're getting kids to work on in teams, and we're using kids in their age group as their user group. So think about a challenge or a need or a problem that kids in your age group are facing, and how can you solve that problem?
And what week is that? What's the dates?
It is actually this week, so it's going on right now.
Oh, so it started, okay.
At the PC Caps building.
And this is, it looks to me like you have camps going in 4 different states.
We do.
And now, are these destination camps, or is it local kids, local Park City kids who are taking part in this?
Mostly they're local Park City kids. We do have a program at St. Paul's School in Concord, New Hampshire, where we're bringing in kids from all over the state and perhaps other states outside of New Hampshire. So some of those programs are bringing in multiple different kids from different backgrounds.
And why Park City? Why are our kids smarter and better looking, or like Wobegon, or what?
So that's a great question. We're our founder, Eric Jacobson, is based here. You might know he has he's managing Dauphin Capital Group, and he's been very involved in the Park City Education Foundation, was a former board president. So the networks that he has here have opened up a lot of doors. We've been working with Ember Conley, the superintendent of Park City School District, and a number of teachers, as well as Jennifer Jackenthal at PC Caps, and that was how we got the space and how we got started.
I'm glad you mentioned Eric, because I knew he was affiliated, but I didn't know we could talk about it. Eric's a very successful entrepreneur himself.
Yes.
Back in the late 80s, early 90s, he wrote tech software that I believe he sold to H&R Block. So when you now use H&R Block software for preparing your taxes, that was software Eric and his partner developed.
Yep. That's absolutely right.
I was really excited to see Eric was doing this here locally. What about the adult program? Is that still going on in the future, or is that going on this week as well?
We don't have an adult program this summer, but we definitely have plans to expand this to the adult and executive education populations.
So, you mentioned a senior program. You have a kids program and a senior program. What's the senior program?
The senior program is for kids aged 14 through 17.
So okay. That's
the local
a different definition. I was thinking maybe my age group, but okay. I'm a little past
you
that
can't,
age now.
You can't sign up, Doug. Sorry.
Maybe one day.
have any actual businesses, marketable ideas come out of these camps that you've held in the past?
So our first actual pilot of this program was in Atlanta. And the kids actually came up with some very tangible, feasible projects. They didn't involve support from corporations or community businesses or anything, but they were very community focused. And we haven't yet had a chance to really explore corporate partnerships yet, but we think, you know, one day there will be a possibility to do that, maybe even later this summer.
You know, it would be fun to do, Larry. I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here, but what if, like, one of you guys have some kind of contest in there, and whoever the kid is that wins that, we give them a little bit of airtime here on Mountain Money sometime
sure.
this summer.
Wonderful.
Maybe get Eric to come in as well and talk about the program, if that would work.
That would be great. Love to do
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, we've had, Doug, as you recall, some entrepreneurs here who were like 9 and 10 with
snowboard.
Who was
that girl that was making like $10,000 a year selling these earrings,
yeah.
figurines? They look like different characters.
And then we had others who were designing snowboarding gear
yep.
for their
jib jab or jib something.
Something like that. And yeah, so we've got kind of a bright bunch. And,
we do.
Kids get it early on. You can be 11 and figure out that the way to get ahead in life for me is to create something and sell it.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad the response from the community has been so strong.
Yes.
I looked at it when it first came out, and I was surprised as we were looking at camps for my daughters for this summer. I was like, oh, this one sounds perfect. And I would just, in the back of my mind, knew it was going to be full when I clicked on it. And I clicked, this is about a month ago, and there was still room.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, basketball camp overlaps with it. So this summer, we can't do it. But is the idea that you'll go back to the same communities following years
yes.
and just kind of build on previous years?
That's our goal. Absolutely.
Good. Well, hopefully you'll have one of the Wells daughters in your class here sometime
Wonderful.
Soon. So, Lindsay, are you a local as well?
I'm not. I'm actually based in Atlanta.
Okay. So you're here just for the week?
Just for the week, yes.
Okay. Well, welcome. Our guest this morning is Lindsay Mangoni, Executive Director of the Center for Entrepreneurship. They're running a very cool program for kids this week here in Park City. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to cfesummer.org and learn more about it. And we will be back in just a minute to talk about a new app that it doesn't mow your lawn. I don't think you can
Let's bill it at that. People have to listen in to hear how your iPhone app can mow your lawn or plow your driveway.
So we will come back and talk about plows and mows after this.
This is Christian Bohr with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Joining the Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members enjoy a wide array of benefits, including instant credibility, weekly newsletters with relevant information, educational seminars, webinars, and much more. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Two interesting conversations. We're going to stay with the entrepreneurial theme. And now we're going to speak with Wills Mahoney, the co-founder of Plows and Mows. Mows. I told you, Larry, I'd do that by mistake. Wills, are you on the line?
I sure am. Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Doug, for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, it just looks like it ought to rhyme.
It does. Unfortunately, the way the English language works, it doesn't. So
it just doesn't work out that way. Yeah, right.
So, Wills, give us a quick highlight. What does Plows and Mows do?
Sure. So, this is an app that's available for both the iPhone, iPad, Android operating system. Simply, in your market, you can either request a plow or a lawn mowing service come right to your house with the tap of a few buttons. Within the app, you basically answer a few questions, and then within real time, you're calculated an exact price on how much it will be, to have a provider come to your house and mow your lawn. You can choose the exact date of when you want the provider to arrive as well. So we make it really easy and, convenient for anyone. You can be in Florida doing this, or, if you've got something that you'd rather do on a Saturday as opposed to mowing your lawn, now you've got, a tool in your pocket that you can just tap a few buttons and, summon a lawn provider.
And what's the business model? You sell the app, or do you get a referral fee from the plow company, or what?
Yeah, so with the providers, we take a small commission. Keep in mind with that, we manage a very large marketing budget for these providers. We also, manage all the sales tax, and on top of it, we have a 24-hour customer service center. So we deal with all customer inquiries. So we say to these plow providers and these lawn providers, do what you do best. We're gonna manage the paperwork for you, and on top of it, all the providers get paid via ACH within 24 hours. So they're no longer having to, chase an invoice for a couple months. They're getting paid right away.
So, Wills, I'm curious. When I was 14, 15 years old, I was mowing lawns like a lot of kids probably here in Park City, and I quickly figured out, boy, if I could get other people to mow the lawns that I had signed up to kind of contract with me, I could do a lot more lawns. And so the deal I had with people was, whoever provided the lawnmower and gas got a third of whatever we collected. Whoever did the lawn mowing got 50%. And I got the rest, which, if you do the math, is about 17%. So I'm curious, has the economics of that model changed much in the 40 years since I was
mowing lawns? Doug, you were that mercenary as a little kid?
I had to pay my own way through college, and so I
you probably did pretty well doing that, too. We take a small percentage for every job that's done.
Is that about 15%?
It fluctuates, but it can be somewhere around there, up to 30%, depending on there's a couple different metrics that are involved. But for what we found, the providers love it because we're giving them opportunity for new jobs all over the area. Plus, our retention rate is around 80%. So they're not just getting maybe one job. They're getting multiple jobs out of this from the same client. So we think that's exciting for them and a great reason for these providers to sign up as well.
Now, is this going to be your only product line? I would think you could do this for just about any service, for a plumber, an electrician, a carpenter, anything like that. Are those apps already out there, or is this just one example of any number that could be generated?
Yeah, there's a lot of different products that we can offer there. But one of the things that we set out to do, when we started this app, we said, hey, we want to do snow plowing really well, and we want to do lawn mowing really well, too. Like, we want to perfect that. And then in the future, if we offer more services, you know, we want to make sure we do those just as well. So we don't want to be like some companies that go out there and say, hey, we're gonna offer 100 different services and do them kind of okay. You know, we think it's important that, you know, we've scaled now to Plows and Mows has scaled to 30 cities across the country, and we know quality control is very important. We want every person that uses our service to say, hey, I had an awesome experience with Plows and Mows, and use it again. And I think, you know, if we were to start out and try every different service out there, we wouldn't be able to offer the type of quality control that we're able to offer today.
And of all the services that are out there, why did you pick snow plowing and lawn mowing? And if you're only in 30 cities, why did you launch in Park City?
Well, you know, obviously with the snow and also the lawn mowing, it seemed like a great market to go into. You know, one of the things, we started with plows because, you know, I had a situation where, you know, we had a foot of snow, I couldn't get out of my driveway, and this was a while ago, and if you call a snowplow provider, you're not going to be able to get a hold of them, so you're going to be out of luck and stuck within your driveway. So what we did is we developed this app that, you know, the providers can be, you know, driving around in and be, you know, we track their GPS in real time, so we know exactly where they are. So a job can come in, they can choose to accept it, and, you know, our app is smart because it automatically knows which provider that requests to have the job, which provider is the closest to that job. So we're making it efficient, you know, and, you know, obviously, you know, the consumer is going to get a provider that's right by their house, you know, for plowing, and then the provider is going to be accepting jobs already on their existing route. So we're really optimizing the whole process.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really an example of, you know, just these 100-year-old businesses that are being disrupted now, right? I mean, we have. I saw that Uber is coming to Park City now, which is really disrupting the taxi service. And sure. What you guys are doing is really a more convenient, easier way to do what people have been doing since I was a teenager, hiring people to mow their lawn. So your space is fairly competitive. I mean, it's a great idea. I can see where it's convenient and people would want to go this route. It makes sense for the people that are cutting lawns too, because, you know, they don't want to go be one of three people that are bidding on a job, spend an hour building a relationship with the homeowner and maybe getting the contract and maybe not. And I know all that because when I was a kid, that's what I used to do. And I, you know, that was, it takes a lot of time. And you guys are cutting that out. Plus the whole bill collecting, you got to go back and get the money. So you're taking all that out where the landscape person can focus on their business. It's also fairly competitive. I know that there's another startup in Salt Lake City that's in the exact same space. So as you look at the landscape, how do you differentiate yourself from the other folks? I know TaskRabbit is different. It's very similar.
Sure.
You guys are focusing on one or two services, but outside of the focus, how do you guys differentiate yourself from the other folks that are targeting this space?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that we've done that separates us is that you order right through the app, where a lot of these other services you have to do through, you know, through their website. You know, so you can do this right on your mobile phone, the entire ordering process, whether from the time you sign up to the information that you enter, and then to the checkout process. And then on top of it, the app is set up where you're constantly notified throughout the process. You know, when the provider's on his or her way, when the job's complete, and on top of it, you get an actual picture of the completed job. So, you know, it's great for people that are, you know, property owners, like landlords, you know, people that are out of state, or just, you know, just the reassurance of knowing, hey, my lawn was done at 3 o'clock today, or my driveway was plowed at 4 p.m., and I know I'm going to be able to get in my driveway.
Yeah, you know, Doug was saying, you know, that you're a disruptor with this app, and it's really true, because I know from being stuck on several HOA boards that when you when you bid out landscaping and especially plowing, most of the operators around here will only do it on a season-long contract in which you pay a flat fee every month, And I know where I live, I don't think that we had a light winter, and I don't think the plow guy showed more than four or five times, and he was collecting $400 a month for 5 months. And this totally disrupts that model if you can just call on demand when you need it.
Sure. And the thing is, too, you know, with the consumer, a lot of the consumers like it because they're not locked into a contract. Or, you know, we had so many instances where, you know, kids of parents that were out of town, you know, parents that were stuck would order it for their parents and kind of get them out of a bind. So, you know, we thought that was really cool. And then on top of it, you know, it's also been a really cool Father's Day idea as well. We've been getting a lot of orders for parents, you know, shooting out a unique gift for Father's Day this upcoming week.
I do think that's a great idea. We're speaking with Wills Mahoney, co-founder of Plows and Mows. Will, thank you for joining us, and good plug there. Father's Day's coming up. Give your dad the gift of a Sunday afternoon
of
off.
Not mowing. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, Will's, let him barbecue and not have to you know, lawn mow this weekend. We're trying to make everyone's life a little bit easier here, and we think we have a great, you know, product. So, you know, all you have to do is visit our website, Mows App, MOWZAPP.com, you know, to learn more information about us. You know, if you have any questions, feel free to give us a call. You know, there's always someone here 24/7.
All right. And I did see, at least on the Apple App Store, you can just download the app automatically on your iPhone as well.
Sure. Yep. Yeah. Within the iTunes Store or the Android Marketplace, it's available. We'll actually be offering web ordering too at some point this week. We're going to be adding that feature. So if for some reason you don't have an iPhone or an Android device, you can, you know, you'll be able to order right from our website as well.
Great. Wills, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Mound Money on KPCW, and we'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Thank you so much, Larry and Doug.
Take care.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital that's part of the Intermountain Healthcare family. Healing from an orthopedic injury can be a difficult challenge, but our physical therapy team uses the most advanced tools to help you recover, like a SwimX therapy pool, which allows you to swim against a current or run on an underwater treadmill. Our state-of-the-art gym equipment addresses injury-specific cardio, strength, and balance therapies so you can return to work or play as quickly as possible. Learn more at parkcitymedicalcenter.org.
This is Sean Railton. I'm an agent with Park City Realty Group. I'm a 30-year Park City resident and a KPCW underwriter. I have been involved in the Park City real estate market since 1994 as an agent, an appraiser, and an investor. I can be reached at 649-1991 or Sean at parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery, we know what grows, parkcitynursery.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to the final minutes of Mountain Money. I want to let you know that next week on the show, we're going to have Scott Schaefer with us. He's one of the authors of Roadside MBA, Back Road Lessons for Entrepreneurs, Executives, and Small Business Owners. In addition to being an author, he's a University of Utah professor. Also, we're going to talk a little further about real estate and the Berkshire Hathaway name change for Prudential, which has been the name for one of the leading firms in town for quite some time. And Chris Getze with Volo, a business consultant in the hospitality services business, will be here. And tomorrow in this space, This Green Earth.
You know, Larry, I think we talked to Scott Schaefer about a year and a half ago. He's an economist at the U.
I forget
what the topic was, but it's when Delta Airlines bought a refinery, and he and I talked about whether that was a smart thing or not when he was our guest last time. He's an entertaining guest, so it'll be a good show.
Yeah, and we just have 30 seconds. Let's get the 30-second take on this market. They were talking about it on Marketplace today that my gosh, it just goes up and up and up, and it hasn't had the 10% correction it usually does.
Yeah, it worries me when I hear people say it goes up and up and up, because it doesn't. But, you know, we're through earnings season. Companies have done well. Inflation's low. Interest rates are low. Earnings are good. So we've got really the foundation for continued success. But I would expect a 10% correction sometime this year, at least 5%.
Okay. And I want to thank our great sponsors for Mountain Money. It's Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, the Iron Mountain Group, the Park City Chamber, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and Jones Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough. Thank you all for sponsoring this and other public affairs shows on KPCW. Means a lot to us. Really appreciate it. Almost out of time, but I want to remind you that it's This Green Earth tomorrow. And also I'd urge everyone who is a fan of this show and others to go to our website and click on the silver microphone logo and see if you can become a member of our Broadcasters Club. We are looking for new recruits all the time. Okay, it's time for the news. This is KPCW, Park City.